O Eternal, you're my God. I'll exalt you. I'll praise your name, for you've done wonderful things. Your counsels of old are faithfulness and truth. If men just listen to those. So here, at a time when Christ is reigning in Mount Zion, he looks back at God's counsels of old. That doesn't sound like they're done away with and abolished and outdated and antiquated and the curse and bondage. I'll praise your name because of your counsels of old. They're faithful and they're true. Now you've intervened and you've judged and you've made of a city in heat. You've made out of a defense city, Babylon, all the leading capitals of these nations gathered at Armageddon. You've made of a city a heap, of a defense city a ruin, the palace of strangers to be no city. It'll never be built. So there's that prophecy again repeated about Babylon. You've been a strength to the poor. You've been a strength to the needy in his distress. You've been a refuge from the storm. You've been a shadow from the heat. When the blast of the terrible ones is as a storm against the wall. So you see, your only protection in the future is the Eternal. He's the refuge from the storm. He's the shadow from the heat. You'll bring down the noise of strangers as the heat in a dry place. The heat with the shadow of a cloud, the branch of the terrible one shall be brought low. Of course, here he's talking about all of the world's leaders that are threatening human annihilation. They're like trees, and the branch of those, just the family or the dynasty, the palace. And in this mountain shall the Eternal of Hosts make unto all people a feast of fat things. In this mountain, what is he talking about? The only one mentions back up in verse 23, Mount Zion. So if you go right back up to the antecedent of the term, then you find out it's talking about Mount Zion, Capitol Hill, all through the millennium. And isn't it interesting? Man's always built his capitals on hills, just like God always has. So now, out of Zion, after God has intervened and destroyed the destroyers of the earth, now God is going to set up a millennial feast. And we'll have the tabernacles for 1,000 years. The Eternal Host make to all people a feast of fat things, a feast of wines on the lees, of fat things full of marrow, of wines on the lees, well refined. So here he's talking about the choicest, aged wine. High-quality wine, the choicest of eating, like just describing the Feast of Tabernacles. That's the way the Feast of Tabernacles is. It's the time of the year when you feast on the best things. The best of wines, you can't afford the rest of the year. And he'll destroy in this mountain the face of the covering cast over all people. In other words, they're going to all be enlightened. They'll all be called. Blindness, spiritually, will be taken away. So at the time he comes back and sets up capital on Zion, all the blindness of the Asiatics and the Africans and the Europeans will be removed. The veil is spread over all nations. And why can't people see the truth about predestination? I don't see how people can help but see it. And the fact that they can't see it is proof in itself that they are blind. Because it's all the way through the Bible. And here it's very plain. Later, that veil. What is that veil? Well, I think you know 2 Corinthians 3:15 says it's in the reading of Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. You want to know where the veil of blindness is? It's in reading Moses. So people that understand and know what you're to get when you read Moses aren't blind. The people that take exception to Moses, then, you know, they're blinded. He'll swallow up death in victory. So a lot of dead are going to be resurrected. The word Eternal will wipe away tears from off all faces. And that's where John got that out of in the Revelation. He just borrowed it out of Isaiah 25. It wasn't anything new. Where Paul quotes this about swallowing up death in victory in the resurrection chapter, back in 1 Corinthians 15. And the Lord Eternal will wipe away tears from off all faces. Revelation 7:17 and Revelation 21:4. And the rebuke of his people he shall take away from off all the earth, for the Eternal has spoken it. Now, the rebuke of his people, you might notice Isaiah 38. I guess I got a wrong verse there. We had to forget about that, and I got the wrong verse, the wrong chapter there. It will be said in that day, lo, this is our God, we've waited for him, he will save us. This is the Eternal, we've waited for him, we'll be glad and rejoice in his salvation. More than likely, that's going to be starting out by the Jews. They're going to say, well, look at this, this is the one we've waited for all along, and he really was the Savior, the Messiah. For in this mountain shall the hand of the Eternal rest. 1,000-year rest. See how many times that word rest is associated with the time of peace and the restoration of God's kingdom? In this mountain, the mountain of God, the kingdom of God. Again, showing the mountains a symbol of the kingdom. The hand of the Eternal shall rest. And Moab shall be trodden down under him, even a straw. It's trodden down for the dunghill. Now, that doesn't mean Moab won't exist in the future, but at first, apparently, Egypt's going to be stubborn and hard-headed about converting over to God, the God of the Bible, and forsake their Islam religion. But apparently, Moab also is going to be a little bit hard-headed and stubborn. So, Moab is going to be trodden down under him. I wonder why it mentions Moab in the middle of a chapter that doesn't refer to anybody else. Well, I don't know the answer. I just know the question on that one. Moab shall be trodden down. Is that because the place where God's people are is in the land of Moab? Well, no doubt about it. Petra's in the old country of Moab. Well, you know, if you've got any other ideas, I'd like to hear them. Why does he talk about Moab in the context of a chapter and a paragraph content like that? Moab's going to be threshed like straw that's trodden under. He'll spread forth his hands in the midst of them as he that swims spreads forth his hands to swim. Even the Bible tells you how to swim. And he'll bring down their pride together with the spoils of their hands, and the fortress of the high fort of your walls shall he bring down, lay low, and bring to the ground, even to the dust. Boy, that doesn't sound like Moab's a little podunk country. It sounds like there's something special about Moab. And the more you realize, you know, get the word Moab sometime and just look it up all the way through prophecy. You'd be dumbfounded how many times it's mentioned and how prominently it's mentioned. Now, is that because the place God's going to take his people for those years of final training is in Moab? I know it might be. But why would he say here about Moab, he'll spread forth his hands in the midst of them like a swimmer and bring down their pride? Why is Moab all proud? Because they've got the people of God hiding among them and... Well, looks like that God wouldn't bring that down. That looks like that'd be good. What's he going to bring down their pride? The fortress of the high fort. Well, in chapter 26, in that day, this song shall be sung in the land of Judah. So here again is another victory song. Just like the victory song of Moses, except this is one going to be sung of victory in the millennium. We have a strong city. Salvation God will appoint for walls and bulwarks. So in the future, their protection is going to be salvation, the true God, the world government, the capital city, the city of the spirit family of God. We have a strong city. Why is the city strong? Because everybody in it is saved. They're spirit beings. They're born of God. They're sons of God. That's the walls and bulwarks about the New Jerusalem. Not player New Jerusalem. Open you the gates that the righteous nation, which keeps the truth, may enter in. So all of a sudden, God's people of Israel are going to be referred to the righteous nation. And they're going to be referred to that way because they keep the truth. They live God's way. And the gates will be open. You'll keep him in perfect peace whose mind is stable, and it's because he trusts in you. Trust you in the eternal forever, because in the eternal is everlasting strength. And of course there's the famous verse that the rock of ages. That's what Hebrew says, the rock of ages. So the old Protestant song that they've sung forever literally is in the Bible. The rock of ages, right here in Isaiah 26. For he brings down them that dwell on high, the lofty city, he lays it low. He lays it low to the ground. That's Babylon. That's the Babylon that's fallen. That's the city of confusion that he referred to back in the previous chapter. So here he keeps coming back to Babylon and her fall and her position in the world. The foot shall tread it down, the foot of the poor, the steps of the needy, the way of the just is uprightness. You, most upright, do weigh the path of the just. Yea, in the way of your judgment, O Eternal, we've waited for you. Yeah, God, we want to learn Exodus 21 and 22 and 23, and we want to get up on your judgments, God, because we're going to have the Jubilee years when Christ comes back. We're going to have the seventh year release. We're going to have all of God's laws back in effect. So we say, yea, in the way of your judgments, O Eternal, we've waited for you. That's an odd way to term that, isn't it? As if you're just waiting for God so all the judgments can be put back in effect in the earth. The desire of our soul is to your name. Do you remember right away what that reminds you of back in Malachi? Notice back in the book of Malachi, chapter 3, verse 16. Then they that feared the Eternal spake often to one another, and the Eternal hearkened and heard it, and the book of remembrance was written before him for them that feared the Eternal, and that thought upon his name. Now, what kind of a person are you if you go around many times through the day and you think about all of God's names, and you think about being in the God family, and you think about being John Brown Elohim, or Mary Beth Elohim, you know? You talk to one another often about being in the God family and having the God family power. That's what we should do. And notice it says, if you fear the Eternal, then you do speak often to one another and talk about God's name. So maybe if you want to know whether you're one of these that fear God, all you've got to do is weigh yourself by those scales. Do you speak often to one another about God's name? Well, look what God says about them in verse 17. They shall be mine, says the Eternal Host. But it's just like someone that's real hungry and dreams, and they think what a great thing it would be to possess the nations of Israel, the wealthy, prosperous, powerful countries. So when the beast power finally accomplishes that, though, it'll be like a hungry man had a dream and enjoyed the eating, but then he awakes and his soul is empty. Now here again is a good place to mark in your Bible. Soul. Either immortal soul, I-S as I mark it, or just the word soul in the margin. Because people would have you believe that everybody has an immortal soul, and that's what God raptures to heaven, and that's the eternal part of a man, but notice here, a soul is hungry. It's empty. So whoever had an empty soul, as far as the Protestant understanding. But here's someone who awakes and his soul is empty. It's obvious your stomach, in this case, is referred to as a soul. It's the physical life of a being. As when a thirsty man dreams, and behold he drinks, but he awakes, and behold he's faint, and his soul has appetite. That's weird. You know, nobody in the Baptist church told me my soul had appetite. Your soul's immortal. It doesn't have any appetite and can't be empty. Certainly couldn't be your belly. Well, it is here. His soul has appetite. So shall the multitude of all the nations be that fight against Mount Zion. So now he brands who Ariel is. Mount Zion, where David dwelt. Obviously talking about Jerusalem through here. So now in verse 9, since he's introduced Mount Zion, He refers to Mount Zion. Stay yourselves. Wonder. Cry you out. And cry. They're drunken, but not with wine. They stagger, but not with strong drink. For the Eternal has poured out upon you the spirit of deep sleep, and has closed your eyes, the prophets and your rulers, the seers he has covered. It's a pretty good description of Jimmy Carter, huh? The spirit of deep sleep. Close your eyes, you know. But that's what he's talking about here, the leaders of Israel. He's talking about the leaders of England and Norway and Sweden and Australia and Canada and South Africa. Look what God has done. They're mentally unable to make up their mind. They stagger, but it's not with strong drink. So they cry out and cry, but it's not because they're drunk with wine. But they're confused. They don't know what to do. There aren't any leaders among them anymore. For the Eternal has poured out upon you the spirit of deep sleep, has closed your eyes, the prophets, your rulers. So whether it's Billy Graham, you know, speaking dogmatically that Christ could come back this week, and on the other hand, he might not come back for 1,000 years. So that's a lot of help, isn't it? Really nailing it down. Bringing you in 999 years. Well, God said the prophets and the rulers have had their eyes covered. They're blinded. There's a deep sleep on them. And the vision of all is becoming to you as the words of a book which is sealed, which men deliver to one that's learned, saying, read this, I pray you. And he says, I can't. So you find out in Israel, the religious leaders, they can't understand the Bible. You can hand them a Bible and ask them to explain it to you and expound it and enlighten it, and they can't do it. Well, then the book's delivered to him that's not learned. A lot of preachers that way, too, that don't think you need any education. And somebody will hand the book to them and say, read this, I pray you. Well, he says, you can't expect me to read it. I'm not learned. So whether you're learned or ignorant, nobody alike is able to understand the words of God. All the vision of God throughout Scripture is become the words of the book that's sealed. Just like the book of Daniel was to Daniel. So when you read about Martin Luther and his comments about the book of Revelation, that it's a mystery book. And when you read other great religious leaders' comments about parts of the Bible, you know, it's no wonder they have all the prophecies fulfilled. That's the easiest way to not have to explain them. They're just all already happened. Even the Adventists, most of their ideas about prophecy, they're all already fulfilled. Well, verse 13, wherefore the Eternal said, for as much as this people draw near with their mouth, so they're a religious people. Don't think Israel is atheistic. Israel is not cannibals of the wild lands of Africa or the East Indies. They're religious people. They're people that draw near to God with their lips, but not with their hearts, not with their obedience. The Lord said, for as much as this people draw near me with their mouth and with their lips do honor me. They talk about being born again and knowing the Lord, but they have removed their heart far from me. They won't let God reign in their heart. They won't let God rule them and govern them. Their fear toward me is taught by the precept of men. And that's not very well translated. You can read that in some of the other translations. They make it plainer. A commandment of men in which they've been schooled or taught by rote. In other words, there isn't any real awareness of God that would make you be afraid of the real God of fire and punishment. And, you know, our God is a consuming fire. And we've heard of the goodness and severity of God. But not people that aren't converted. They can't understand any fear of God. They don't want any God that has any fear in his religion at all. I remember talking to one of the students in Big Sandy that couldn't understand how any God with any religion could have any fear in it. And I finally found out the reason was because she was terrified of her dad. She didn't understand awe or reverence or a right good kind of fear. So God says of the fear of the religionist, it's a memorized, it's some type of a rote repetition of a commandment to fear, but it's not inward of the individual's awareness of God and their respect and awe and attitude toward God of being afraid to do what he says not to do. There's an interesting thing that maybe somebody would take the time to study into. I haven't figured this out yet. There's some places when you go through that God talks about the word man or men, and he uses the word Enosh, E-N-O-S-H. Then there are other places where he talks about man, and he uses the word Ish for man. Now, I don't know why he uses one place and the other place. But if you want to make an individual study, you might try to look into that and just see if there's a reason he uses Ish when he does, and if there's a reason he uses Enosh when he does. I know in the New Testament, when the name Jesus is used, there's always a reason for it, because that was the name of a person as an individual. But when the name Christ is used, that's a title. That's more a term like Messiah or anointed. And then when you use the word Jesus Christ, or you use the word Christ Jesus, there's always a reason to choose that way. One is always emphasizing the humanity of the being, and the other is emphasizing the anointing or the capacity or title or job of the individual. But I don't know whether that's the case with Ish and Enosh or not. Well, going on here anyway. Therefore, behold, I'll proceed to do a marvelous work among this people, a marvelous work and a wonder. The wisdom of their wise men shall perish, the understanding of their prudent shall be hid. So here again, God is talking about taking away the great, the leaders, the people that had the character of a George Washington or a Abraham Lincoln or maybe a few in our day, a Churchill perhaps. But all of a sudden, in the end time, when these things are all being fulfilled, the wisdom of the wise has perished, the understanding of the prudent is hid. And here in verse 15, you have a different word. This is not one of the six woes that are outlined here in this section of Isaiah. It's probably where John got the woes in the book of Revelation. Because there are six woes in a row here. This is more a term of exclamation like, aha, to them that seek deep to hide their counsel. In other words, surprise to them who think they're hiding their counsel from God. And their works are in the dark. Because they say, why? Nobody sees us. Nobody knows us. And that's mentioned again. You might jot down Ezekiel 8 and verse 12 beside that. Then said he unto me, Son of man, have you seen what the ancients of the house of Israel do in the dark? Every man in the chambers of his imagery? They say, the Eternal sees us not. The Eternal has forsaken the earth. Now, in what type of religious worship do people have that kind of an attitude? Well, if you read on, he said also to me, you turn yet again and you'll see greater abominations that they do. So whatever he's going to describe isn't trivia. It isn't minor. He calls it a greater abomination. Well, he brings him to the door of the gate of the Eternal's house that's toward the north, and behold, here sit women weeping for Timnah. Then he said to me, do you see this, O son of man? You see this? They're doing this in God's name, following the old heathen, pagan, satanic deceptions, but they're doing it because they say, well, God doesn't see. God's forsaken the earth. And that's the attitude of people when they reason around Christmas or Easter or, you know, even the Los Angeles Times when it repeated Mr. Steep's comments about Halloween. And they commented about the Worldwide Church of God and how we're opposed to Halloween and Easter and Christmas. And you think they worded around it? You think they said God doesn't see? And, well, God doesn't see it that way. There's nothing wrong with the tree. It's harmless. Well, that's their attitude about practicing things God doesn't say to do. Have you seen this, O Son of Man? You turn yet again, you'll see greater abominations than these. So he brings him into the inner court of the eternal house. So here are supposed churches of God, Christian churches supposedly. And behold, at the door of the temple of the eternal, between the porch and the altar, 25 men with their backs toward the temple of the eternal, their faces toward the east, there at Easter sunrise service, worshiping the sun toward the east. Then he said to me, have you seen this, O Son of Man? Is it a light thing? So notice how people pass it off. They say, why, that isn't any big deal. That's not important. Why make a mountain out of a molehill, you know? If you turn it into something Christian and there's a good spirit of giving at that time, and, you know, why major in the minors? As one of our men in the past took great delight in expressing it. Why major in the minors? Minor little things like Easter and Christmas and Halloween, and, you know, they cancel their reprint article on Valentine's Day. So I guess the next thing, we'd had church members honoring old Catholic Saint Valentine, you know, passing around Cupids, shooting hearts, and bringing in all the Halloween, or not Halloween, but Valentine practices. But notice the terminology God uses toward the Israelitish attitude when they practice these abominations. They do it with the attitude, well, God doesn't see us. That, well, God's forsaken the earth. He's left us here to go on our own. And the old days like Israel, those are of the past. And why, it's a minor anyway. It's just a tree. It's just a Easter rabbit with eggs. And why, it's nothing bad. Just a fun night out and Halloween, you know. It's a light thing that they commit the abominations they commit. Well, back to Isaiah 29 again. It's quite a common attitude of Israel. You might jot down Psalm 94 and verse 7. We won't take the time to turn and read there, but the same thing is expressed. The attitude toward Israel, practicing their heathen paganism, is, well, God doesn't see. They seek deep to hide their counsel from the eternal, and their works are in the dark, and they say, who sees us? Who knows us? Surely, you turn things upside down. God says, the seventh day is the Sabbath. They say, no, it isn't. The first day is the Sabbath. God says, have all your holy days in the summer, in the spring, and the fall. And they say, no, have them in the winter. Halloween, and Thanksgiving, and Christmas, and New Year's Day. And the only reason Easter isn't in the winter is because it's copied after Passover. If it weren't, it would be in the winter, too. You think how many ways they turn things upside down. God says you'll surely die. They say, no, you won't. You're an immortal soul. God says you'll surely die. They say, no, you won't. You'll burn forever. God says, blessed are the meek, they'll inherit the earth. They say, no, they won't. They're going to all go to heaven. You know, whatever you say black, it turned out white. You turn things upside down. And that's going to be esteemed as the potter's clay. In other words, when you take what God says and then you go ahead and do just the opposite, God said, honor your father and mother, but you say, it's Corbin. And God said, you'll not steal, but you say. God said, don't commit adultery, but you say. So you're turning the things upside down. It's going to be esteemed as the potter's clay. Now, what does that mean? Well, can the work say of him that made it, he didn't make me? But sure enough, we do that. We evolve from green slime. And we evolve from orangutans. And we evolve from all kinds of things. Well, the work actually says of him that made it, he didn't make me. I'm not created, I'm just evolved. Or shall the thing framed say of him that framed it, he has no understanding? And what's wrong with God? Why didn't he make us with eight arms? A lot of times we need eight arms, don't we? And wouldn't it be nice if you had a face on all four sides so that nobody could sneak up behind you? Like the lady in England that time, Raymond McNair, was standing at this bus stop, and this lady was bellyaching about the way God made her. You know, she had a whole arms full of packages, and she wished she had eight arms. And she was complaining about all the ways God made her. You know, she wished she had a face on the back of her head so she wouldn't miss the bus. And she was commenting about what a poor job God did. Well, Mr. McNair took her to task on it. He said, well, would you imagine what that'd be like trying to sleep and had eight arms? And it's hard enough finding a position to sleep as it is without having eight arms coming out. He said, can you imagine all the accidents you'd have if you had four faces? And then you'd just be jumpy to no end. And you imagine, you know, if you couldn't hear anybody, except when you raised your arms, you know, you had your ears under your arms. So if you didn't want to listen to anybody, you'd just stand there and you wouldn't listen. But if you did want to listen, you'd have to stand there like that all the time. And he talks about eating, you know, complaining about why they put your mouth down here right at your stomach, or go right there, you know, why go through all this. And so then every time you'd have to eat, you'd have to open your shirt and put it in there. So he had her nailed down to good on that, but isn't that what people say? The God that made us, they deny the Creator, they deny that He made us, and then they complain about the way He made us. Well, I wish God hadn't made the races. I wish God hadn't made me yellow or black or brown, or wish God hadn't made this or that. Well, God had all the understanding, and He did it just perfectly. Now, it's not but a little while, and Lebanon shall be turned into a fruitful field. Of course, Lebanon was just a symbol of a forested country, the cedars of Lebanon. You'll see a little later in chapter 32 and verse 15, that Lebanon is used as a type of a land just totally covered with trees. Now, it might mean a massive army, a forest, or it might just mean literally trees. But in the future, Lebanon is going to be plowed and planted. It's going to be productive agriculturally. It isn't going to just be known for forest, and that's all. And yet a very little while, and Lebanon is going to be turned into a fruitful field, and the fruitful field is going to be esteemed as a forest. So then they'll realize the value of being able to produce your own food. And in that day, there's the dead giveaway now, beginning in verse 17, he's talking about a millennial type period, but is it the millennium? Or is it maybe a day of judgment after the millennium? Well, in that day, the deaf shall hear the words of the book, and the eyes of the blind shall see out of obscurity and out of darkness. So it's a time of miracles, when the deaf not only are able to hear, but when they're converted, their ears hear the words of the book. So when God talks about if you have ears to hear, that means you're converted. He's opened your ears. He's opened your eyes and enlightened you and given you the truth. So in that day of the millennium or that day of the judgment period after that, the deaf are going to hear the words of the book, and the eyes of the blind are going to see out of obscurity and out of darkness. So that's talking about everybody that's blinded spiritually, blinded to God's truth. The meek are going to increase their joy in the eternal, and the poor among men are going to rejoice in the Holy One of Israel. For the terrible one is brought to naught, and the scorner is consumed, and all that watch for iniquity are cut off, that make a man an offering for a word. Now this is not very well translated. They bring a man into condemnation by their word. In other words, it's talking about false witness. People that make a man an offender by their word. He's not really an offender, but they lie. They bear false witness. He's talking about all that watch for iniquity. In other words, people that are just out looking for other people's faults and troubles. Lay a snare for him that reproves in the gate. In other words, they're talking about evil people that are persecuting the righteous people. So, if you reprove in the gate, if you say Christmas and Easter are pagan, if you say Saturday's the Sabbath, you're not supposed to eat all those unclean foods, then they're going to lay a snare for any of us who reprove in the gate. Of course, the gate's where the leaders dwell. The gate's where the leaders of countries dwell. And here, the people of God are going to be persecuted because of reproving in the gate. And they try to turn aside the just for a thing of naught, trying to get you to follow their pagan and heathen ways instead of going God's way. Therefore, thus says the Eternal, who redeemed Abraham. Now, if you run into people that don't think salvation was offered in the Old Testament, it was to the few that were called. It was to the few God chose. God redeemed Abraham, just like He redeemed you and me and anybody else that's going to be in God's kingdom. So So Abraham's not going to be there some other way. God redeemed Abraham. Concerning the house of Jacob, of course Israel, Jacob shall not now be ashamed, neither shall his face now wax pale. So in the past, though, the house of Israel had to come to be ashamed because of their misleading peoples about God and God's truth and God's nation, God's religion. Their face waxed pale because of the calamity that came on them, the fear and the punishment and the difficulty that came on them. But when he sees his children, the work of mine hands in the midst of him, now that's another poor translation. If you read this passage in some of the other translations, what he's really saying here is, but when his children shall see the work of my hands. So he's talking about the day when the children are going to be brought back to God's way and they're enlightened and granted understanding. And so when the children of Jacob, in this end time, when they're brought back to God, when Jacob's children see the real truth about the work of God's hands, then they'll sanctify God's name. So he's talking about salvation on the house of Israel. And they'll sanctify the Holy One of Jacob and shall fear the God of Israel. Now here again is another interesting title, the God of Israel. You'll find that title here in Isaiah 7 times. Sometimes in the earlier half of Isaiah and sometimes in the later half of Isaiah. So it's another term that shows there aren't two Isaiahs, one bad doom and gloom and the other good. But this term is used throughout Isaiah 7 times. And then when you look at the rest of the Bible, it's used 31 times throughout the rest of the Bible. So altogether it's used 38 times. Which again is a 19 cycle twice. So all the key terms or titles in the Bible are numerically perfect. And that's just another one of many examples. The God of Israel. Is that an important title? Is that an important name? Is that minor that he's the God of Israel? No, it has a foundational cycle, complete cycle number of 19. 38 times it's here in the Bible. They also that erred in spirit shall come to understanding, and they that murmured shall learn doctrine. So here he's talking about the time of salvation in the millennium, and then from that time forward. When is the house of Jacob going to come to salvation? Well, the ones that continue alive in the millennium. But the ones that have died are going to have to be resurrected, and they're going to come to it in the 100-year period. Now in chapter 30, he goes on with another one of the woes. This is the fourth of the woes. Well, the third of the woes. Woe to the rebellious children. Stubborn or backsliding children, says the Eternal, that take counsel, but not of me, and that cover with a covering, but not of my spirit, that they may add sin to sin. So here you can either take this physically, and here again, the religious leaders aren't going to understand the Bible when it's given to them and they're told to explain it, as we read in chapter 29. If somebody comes to me, you know, and they want to give me all the modern scholars' comments about parts of the Bible, a lot of times I'll just say, well, how long's that guy been in the church? Adam Clark, when was he baptized? JFB, I never remember them being baptized. You know, those guys are going to tell me all about what the Bible says? Well, when my Bible says they don't understand it. My Bible says that they're blinded to it. You can give them the book and say, here, explain this to me. And they're going to say, well, I can't, it's sealed. And that's one key a lot of us need to learn. I almost got sidetracked with the truth back when I came to college. I learned all the truth I'd learned through Mr. Armstrong. And then I got out here and I got into the library and I was digging out all these books and somebody asked me about Melchizedek. Of course, then I thought it was Melchizedek. I didn't even know how to pronounce the name, much less who he was. So I got out the commentaries, and I was going to learn all this truth about Melchizedek from all these commentaries. Boy, I got my brain scrambled, but good. You know, they told me answers to the questions. It said, without father or mother. Well, that just meant they lost his chronology. It said, without beginning or ending of days. And that just meant they didn't have his birth record or any records in the record, see? So I'd read along there, and it said, without father or mother, without beginning or ending of days. And it didn't mean to me what it meant to everybody else, because I'd gotten all these carnal-minded scholars' opinions for it. Well, thankfully, God allowed me to get over that blindness and error, and I went to talk to somebody, and they explained it. And it took me a long time to get out of my head what I'd gotten from those carnal books and had put in my head. And it's kind of like Dr. Hay, when he came to college, and he wanted to find out about the Passover and the days of unleavened bread, so he got out all these carnal books by these carnal writers, you know, and he started digging in there and got his brain all scrambled, and he thought the Passover was a night to be much remembered, and got some scriptures all entangled on it, and, well, you know, time went on, he got together and had studies with Mr. Armstrong, and his mind had already been filled with what these other books said, and he couldn't see it, and couldn't see it, and he really underwent an intellectual battle. You know, he underwent a battle for his mind of control. Who's he going to listen to? Where did he get all the other truth he'd gotten? Well, the mother, the church, taught him. But all of a sudden, Satan was trying to snatch away the seed, I believe, like he tried there with me on that Melchizedek. Well, Dr. Hay studied and pondered and thought and reasoned, and Mr. Armstrong did a mental battle with him every week or two. And finally, right before the Passover, Mr. Armstrong was in his home out on Hill Street, and he heard somebody yelling. And he went to the front door, and here was Dr. Hay running across his front yard. He was saying, I see it, I see it, I see it! And he didn't need to see it a month ahead. He couldn't have kept the Passover till it came anyway. But to me, there's a great lesson there, that when he had to see it, God intervened and allowed him to see it. But I think he learned a lesson there that he never did forget. And it's too bad some other men didn't learn that lesson that came along later, because they put more confidence in carnal minds, in books they'd read about the Bible, rather than the inspiration of the Holy Spirit. And you know, that's really what that verse means in Paul's writings, where he said, you have an unction from the Father, you have the Holy Spirit, why should you look to unconverted men to guide you? That doesn't mean you shouldn't look to men to guide you, because the story of the Ethiopian eunuch would contradict that. But sometimes we need to learn the lesson that we should have gotten here out of Isaiah 29, that you can deliver this book to the great thinkers and the great brains and the great scholars and the great Hebrew and Greek specialists, but unless they have God's Spirit, unless they have the Mother, they're not going to understand it. Well, going on back to Isaiah 30, the rebellious children. Now, Ezekiel chapter 2 and verse 3, here again ties in the unity of the prophets. Ezekiel 2, he said to me, Son of man, stand upon your feet, and I'll speak to you. And the Spirit entered into Ezekiel when God spake to him and set Ezekiel upon his feet, that he heard the one that spake to him. And he said to me, Son of man, I send you to the children of Israel. And here is a rotten mistranslation. Two rebellious nations. That's what the Hebrew says there. Israel's not one nation. When God sends Ezekiel's meaning for the end time down to the children of Israel, they're rebellious nations, plural. They have rebelled against God. They and their fathers have transgressed against God, even to this very day. They're impudent. Hard of face is the word. Argumentative. Bullheaded, stubborn, blockheaded. So, you know, why should anybody get all puffed up about being an Israelite? You know, about when you've read this far along, you say, well, maybe I better be a Russian, or maybe I'll be better off I'm a German or something. But when you read about what God says about the children of Israel, and you remember how bullheaded Jacob was, impudent children, stiff-hearted, I do send you to them, and you'll say to them, thus says the Lord God.
Well, back to Isaiah 30. We're the rebellious children, says the Eternal. They carry out a plan, all right. They take counsel, all right. But they don't look into the Bible for God's counsel. They don't ask God what to do. That cover with a covering. In other words, they're seeking protection. They're wanting to be covered and protected, but not by God's covering and protection. They're going to use human reasoning. And when it's best to be buddies with Arabs, then you better be buddies with the Arabs. And then when it's best to be buddies with the Europeans, then you better be buddies with the Europeans. And keep buying lovers, you know. Don't just independently go the way of God and let the rest of the world take care of itself. No. They cover with a covering, but it's not God's Spirit. And they go right on adding sin to sin. Those are missing the mark, the words for sin there. And they walk to go down into Egypt, like envoys would or ambassadors would. They haven't asked at my mouth. They didn't ask me, should I go down into Egypt? I've sent my prophet saying, don't trust in Egypt. And I'm beginning to wonder, the more I study into Egypt and Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel, if between now and the great battle of the end time, we may not be doing a great deal of bartering and allying with the United Arab Republic. You see all the oil situation coming on. God may well be describing what we're going to do in the next few years right here. We're going to have our hat in our hand as we go down to the Arab world. And yet we don't ask God whether we should do that or not. But we're going to strengthen ourselves in the strength of Pharaoh, and we're going to trust in the shadow of Egypt. Now, that's not what Israel should do. They should be trusting under the shadow of God. Therefore shall the strength of Pharaoh be your shame, and the trust in the shadow of Egypt your confusion. So apparently, if we begin to make overtures toward the Arab world, then all of a sudden, what's that going to do to us as far as the Europeans and toward the Jews even? And if we begin to trust in the shadow of Egypt, in the end, that's going to be the confusion of Israel. Maybe that's one of the reasons the nations of Europe are going to turn on us. Because we begin to trust in the shadow of Egypt, we begin to look to the strength of Pharaoh, and that's going to be our shame and our confusion. For his princes were at Zoan, and his ambassadors came to Hanes. Now, Zoan's been a very prominent place in history. In the time of Moses, it was the capital or the court of the Pharaoh. Even the very scenes of the miracles that are listed back in Psalm 78, you might remember they were done in the fields of Zoan. Psalm 78, verses 12 and 43. And you remember back in Isaiah 19, verses 11 and 13, it talked about Zoan being the seat of wisdom of Egypt, the dwelling place of their princes and their royalty. That's where the Exodus began. If you remember back in Numbers 13, verse 22. And it's referred to again in Ezekiel 30, in verse 14. So that's been quite a prominent area. His ambassadors came to Hanes, one of the chief cities of Egypt. We read that back in chapter 19 and verse 11, if you didn't jot that down before. They were all ashamed of the people that couldn't profit them. So now all of the peoples of Israel, the rebellious children that trusted in Egypt, and then that ended up being their shame, then they're going to be ashamed of the people, the Arabs, that couldn't profit them. Well, I wonder why they couldn't. Well, maybe because of the Asiatics or because of the Europeans, they couldn't be the help or prophet for them that they expected they would be. But instead of being a prophet, they ended up being a shame and a reproach. Now, we know that's true physically. Back in the days of Sennacherib and in the historical days of the original fulfillment of this. But what about the duality and the parallel in our day? All of us as Israel are going to be ashamed of those people that we thought could profit us. We thought they could be a help, and yet they hadn't. They weren't. They ended up being a shame and a reproach against us.
because the Europeans did us in, brought us down and conquered us. The burden of the beasts of the south, and here's pictured again the envoys going down south trying to make treaties and bargains with the Egyptians and loading beasts and loading beasts full of gifts and all kinds of bribes. The burden of the beasts going through the Negev, the wilderness on the way down to Egypt, into the land of trouble and anguish, from whence come the young and old lion, the viper and fiery flying serpent. They'll carry their riches upon the shoulders of young asses, their treasures on the bunches of camels, to a people that shall not profit them. So here you see all of the bartering and bargaining and buying off lovers, making all kinds of bargains with the Arab world. So you might keep your eyes on that in the future and see what we do with all those Arab countries. Because God pictures beasts burdened with bribes and gifts and presents. And you notice when he talks about Egypt, he talks about the young and old lion. So one is the mother Egypt of the Bible days, the old Egypt of the history days, and then the latter lion, the younger lion, one that hasn't been around as long, an Arab lion, not an old Egyptian, the real same people. Not an old Egyptian, the real same people. You know, it's kind of interesting. The Arabs in Egypt aren't Egyptians. If you see the Egyptians of the mummies or the tombs or the archaeology, they're not Arabs. You see King Tut's well, the gold faces on the casket. He's not an Arab. None of those old Egyptians are the same as the people dwelling in the land of Egypt today. So here God, when he talks about Egypt, talks about an old lion and a young lion. One newer people of Egypt in our day, and the old people of Egypt, the Pharaoh people. Of course, the serpent was one of their symbols of their gods. If you were the Pharaoh and you worshipped the gods of Egypt, you'd have a falcon on your forehead or a cobra on your forehead. But here, riches being carried on the shoulders, down to buy off these lovers. For the Egyptians shall help in vain and to no purpose. Therefore have I cried concerning this, their strength is to sit still. Now that's a poor translation, and looking up the verse in the Jewish translation, it makes it a lot plainer in verse 7 there. If I can count backwards here. For Egypt helps in vain and to no purpose. Therefore have I called her arrogancy that sits still. So that's the way the Hebrew is described. God is saying the way he would describe Egypt is arrogancy that sits still. In other words, they're a proud people, and yet they won't help. They don't do anything. They're just arrogancy that sits still. So that's a quote, the way God describes the Egyptians. They're not going to help at all. There's just that pride of antiquity and pride of location, and yet they're just going to sit still and help none at all. So apparently that's what's going to happen to us in the end time when we make some kind of a overtures toward the Arabs and the oil wealth. Then when the time comes for them to help us, they're not going to do anything at all. They're just going to sit there. Sit still. Of course, they're going to get it later anyway when they start pushing at the king of the north. Now going on in verse 8. Now go write it before them in a table, or a tablet, as the word should be. Write it before them in a tablet and note it in a book, that it may be for... Well, look what God says about them in verse 17. They shall be mine, says the Eternal of Hosts, in that day when I make up my special treasure. They're going to be like rubies and emeralds and diamonds and pearls. They're going to be very special. When I make up my special treasure, those that think often on my name and fear me and speak often to one another, they're going to be rare treasures when I make up my special treasure. Well, I'm going to protect them. I'm going to spare them. as a man spares his own son that serves him. And then our job will be to return and discern between the righteous and the wicked, and between one that serves God and one that doesn't serve God. But that's one of the richest scriptures in all the Bible. And yet here Isaiah says the same thing. Verse 8, back in Isaiah 26. Yea, in the way of your judgments, O Eternal, we waited for you. The desire of our soul is to your name. Our very inward longings, our heart pants after you like the heart pants after the water brooks. David said, if I forget Jerusalem, let my right arm fall off of its socket. Boy, we better not go around saying that too often, had we? Maybe it'd be a reminder to you. The desire of our soul is to your name and to the remembrance of you. That's the deepest longing inside of our deepest feelings is to remember God and to think and desire God's name. Imagine what that's going to be when you're Bill Smith Aloham. Boy, the battle's over. No more fighting, old human nature. No more fighting Satan and the world and all the troubles. Then you'll finally relax and you've had it. You got it made. No wonder he says, the desire of our soul. With my soul, I've desired you in the night. That's true. Mr. Armstrong and how many people that can't sleep at night and they wake up and they lie there thinking about God and God's kingdom and Christ's return and God's family and God's words flow through their head and they think of scriptures and is that what happens to you when you wake up at night? It ought to be. With my soul I've desired you in the night. Yea, with my spirit within me I'll seek you early. Which apparently shows that God appreciates getting first place in your time and in your life. For when your judgments are in the earth, the inhabitants of the world will learn righteousness. And I wonder how everybody that's thought they were going to go to heaven and said, oh, I'm sure glad we're away from that curse of that law. Boy, the yoke of bondage, that law is a yoke of bondage. And yet here are people that say, the inhabitants of the world will learn righteousness when your judgments are in the earth. Let favor be showed to the wicked, yet he'll not learn righteousness. In other words, there's a time God knows when someone can be shown favor. But the wicked have to be punished to a degree before they'll turn to righteousness. They won't learn righteousness if you show favor to the wicked. Not until you know the time to finally show favor. So it just shows you can let somebody come back too soon when they are being punished from their sin. But you can't show favor to the wicked too soon. In the land of uprightness will he deal unjustly and will not behold the majesty of the Eternal. So that's why God has to destroy totally some people and let others go through a great deal of punishment, because until that warped, look at the word wicked. He's not talking about a sinner that misses the mark. He's not talking about a transgressor that goes beyond the law. You need to look up the word wicked. The words wicked and evil are about the worst there can be. Abomination is the only one that's any worse. But what do you have to do to become wicked? Well, that's when you've gone the wrong way so long, your nature is so bent. The word literally means bent. So bent that it's hard to be straightened out. Eternal, when your hand is lifted up, they'll not see, but they'll see and be ashamed for their envy at the people. Yea, the fire of your enemies shall devour them. Eternal, you ordain peace for us, for you also have wrought all our works in us. In other words, not any of our doing. God's the miracle worker that called us and enlightened us and gave us his spirit. O Eternal, our God, other lords beside you have had dominion over us. Well, we've known what it's like to be under human authorities in the past, but by you only will we make mention of your name. So when finally there aren't any other human leaders, rulers over other humans, they are dead. Those that have been our rulers over us in the past, they'll not live. They're dead for 1,000 years. They're deceased. They'll not rise. Therefore you have visited and destroyed them and made all their memory to perish. So gradually through the millennium, enough time has to be allowed there to wipe out the memory of Baal. to wipe out the memory of all these wrong ways. You know, that may be another reason the millennium has to be 1,000 years long. Because how long is it going to take to remove out of people's minds the old memories of the old? Nobody will ever remember Christmas anymore after it's been unheard of for 1,000 years. But what if 1,000 years were only 100 years? Well, they wouldn't forget Christmas in 100 years. You haven't forgotten it, and you've been in the church 30 years, maybe. No, you haven't forgotten it yet. You know, I've always wondered why God let the millennium be 1,000 years. Because nobody wants to have to wait that long to see their dead ancestors, to see their dead family they love. So there must be some major reasons for God to let it go 1,000 years. Well, apparently that may be one of them right there. You've increased the nation, O Eternal. You've increased the nation. You're glorified. You've removed it far into all the ends of the earth. You know, he's talking about God's nation of Israel and how they were scattered into all the world. Of course, he's talking about the land of Judah as well from verse 1, and they were scattered into all the world. And then all of a sudden God increased it, so that was fulfilled in the Zionist movement. No, no. That's what they'll tell you, though. You know, they say they fulfilled Isaiah 26:15. They've had Jews come from Russia and all over, and they've all come back to Palestine, and so they've made the desert blossom like a rose, and they've already fulfilled all these scriptures. No, they haven't either. God is going to increase the nation. You know, kids are going to be born during the millennium. After he's removed it afar off to the ends of the earth to punish it, then when he brings it back and sits over it ruling, then it'll grow, it'll increase. Eternal in trouble, they visited you. They poured out a prayer when your chastening was upon them. So it shows how they're going to remember him in foreign countries where they're taken captives. Like as a woman with child that draws near the time of her delivery is in pain and cries out in her pangs, so have we been in your sight, O Eternal. We've been with child, we've been in pain, we have, as it were, brought forth wind. We've not wrought any deliverance in the earth. So, you know, finally, when man comes to the place and he's going to have to say, well, God, it's not in us to do it. We can't do it. All we've done is bring forth wind. We've tried every human government. We've tried all races having their chance. We've tried nothing. It's none of us work, God. We have not wrought any deliverance in the earth, God. Neither have the inhabitants of the world fallen. Your dead men shall live. So here are all the saints raised. God's dead men. Who are God's dead? Well, the dead in Christ. They're God's dead. You're dead. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, David, they're going to live. Together with my dead body, they'll arise. So apparently Isaiah knew he wasn't going to live till Christ returned. Apparently he knew there was plenty of time yet before all the dead would be raised. But he didn't know Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob would be raised. And you know, there are people that say there isn't any Christian doctrines in the Old Testament. There's no promise of eternal life or the resurrection or salvation. I don't know what book they're reading. What else can you get out of that? God's dead shall live. Together with Isaiah's dead body, God's dead shall live. They shall arise. And they're going to arise when God says, awake and sing. So God will give the order. God will give the command, and all of a sudden it'll happen. Awake and sing, you that dwell in dust. Your dew is the dew of herbs, and the earth shall cast out the dead. Boy, isn't that going to be someday when the saints pop out of these cemeteries around here? And you know, another truth of the resurrection is hidden in the sorry translating, because in many places in the New Testament, when it says raised from the dead, if you check the Greek language, it's really saying raised from among the dead. Which shows the other dead are still there. And when it talks about someone being raised up from among the dead, it never does say that about the third resurrection. It says that about people in the first resurrection. They're raised up from among the dead. Christ was raised up from among the dead, which meant the other dead were still down there. And this verse shows the dead were still down there in the time of Isaiah. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, they weren't anywhere. They were dead. They were in the dust. So at the resurrection morning, when God gives the command, he says, arise, awake, sing, you that dwell in dust. The earth casts out the dead. Come, my people, enter you into your chambers, and shut your doors about you. Hide yourself, as it were, for a little moment, until the great tribulation's passed. That's what he's talking about. Now, what is this talking about? People hiding in death until after the great tribulation? Or is this talking about the living and how they'll be spared through the time of the tribulation? Well, I've just written Peter in the margin here. I got to erase that? Well, I'm not going to erase it until I find out that isn't the case. I'm going to leave it there. Well, verse 19 talks about God's dead. It talks about God's command for the resurrection. And then a new paragraph begins in verse 20. So he's talked about God's dead, and now he's talking about some more of God's people. Well, that must be the ones that are still alive. Are these in verse 20 been dead? Well, let's see. Come, my people, enter you into your chambers. That ever refer to dead? Shut your doors about you. Hide yourself, as it were, for a little moment. See, they're not dead very long. They're not dead at all. Hide yourself for a little moment. As it were, until the indignation of the great tribulation's passed. For behold, the eternal comes out of his place to punish the inhabitants of the earth for their iniquity. The earth also shall disclose her blood and shall no more cover her slain. So finally, God is going to punish the earth for all the bloodshed, and God's people are protected during that great tribulation. So that doesn't depend on church errors. You know, you don't have to believe in church errors to believe God's people are protected in the end time from the great tribulation. Now, chapter 27, he goes on, in that day, just like chapter 26 started, in that day the Eternal, with his sore and great and strong sword, shall punish Leviathan, the piercing serpent, even Leviathan, that crooked serpent, and he'll slay the dragon that's in the sea. So apparently this is kind of a duality of the Day of Atonement. As the sin of the world was put back on Satan, the serpent, on the Day of Atonement, finally God is going to punish the piercing serpent for all the sin of the world. So apparently that's what this is referring to again. In that day, sing you unto her a vineyard of red wine. A new paragraph starting there. I, the Eternal, do keep it. I'll water it every moment, lest any hurt it. I'll keep it night and day. Now, is this the planting of God's vine of Israel in the new heavens, or in the kingdom? Well, sure is. Lest any hurt it, I'll keep it night and day. Fury is not in me. In other words, his fury has already been poured out. The seventh plague. Who would set fires and thorns against me? I blow through them, I burn them together. Oh, let him take hold of my strength, that he may make peace with me, and he'll make peace with me. So, describing the beginning of the millennium, when nations are going to have to learn that you can't fight God's way, you can't resist God's way. You know, the parable Christ gave was that you go out into the highways and the hedges and compel them to come in. That's a millennial picture. When they're going to be compelled to learn of God's way, and they're going to be forced to either go along God's way or just their lives will be ended. He'll cause them that come of Jacob to take root. So that's the planting of the vine of Israel. So now God replants the vine of Israel back in their lands again. Israel shall blossom and bud and fill the face of the world with fruit. So after he's dealt with Satan in verse 1, now the millennium set up. And, you know, here you are in Isaiah, and you've got the outline of God's plan about Satan having been dealt with, and then the millennium beginning. So that's not an Armstrongism. That's again and again in the Bible. Then in verse 7, has he smitten him as he smote those that smote him? Or is he slain according to the slaughter of them that are slain by him? In other words, did God destroy totally? Did God deal with nations like they dealt with Israel? No. In measure, when it shoots forth, you'll debate with it. He stays his rough wind in the day of the east wind. In other words, God's going to not allow human nature to go too far in the beginning of the millennium. They'll be allowed to learn by experience, but nobody will be allowed to kill. You know, nobody's going to be allowed to go too far. By this, therefore, shall the iniquity of Jacob be purged. So there again, he always comes back and forth to the captivity and the punishment and their iniquity being purged and then being replanted. This is all the fruit to take away his sin when he makes all the stones of the altar as chalk stones that are beaten in sunder. The groves and images shall not stand up. So they're going to all have to be obliterated. Yet the defense city shall be desolate. So here's the time when Jerusalem depended on itself again. And then it had to be desolate. And the habitation had to be forsaken. God had to leave it like a wilderness. There shall the calf feed where humans formerly inhabited. Now it's just animals wandering all over. There shall he lie down and consume the branches thereof. When the boughs thereof are withered, they'll be broken off. There again, likening Israel to trees and then destruction. The women came and set them on fire because it's a people of no understanding. So when Israel was not with God, then they had to be dealt with, punished, their iniquity purged, animals dwelling where formerly humans lived. And then after they learned their lesson, God brought them back and replanted them again. Therefore, he that made them will not have mercy on them, and he that formed them will show them no favor. Now, they're not going to be spared this time. God isn't going to intervene like he did in World War I, World War II, and it'll come to pass in that day, the Eternal shall beat off from the channel of the river unto the stream of Egypt. So like you beat off olives out of an olive tree, in this day when God regathers Israel, enough Israelites are going to be regathered like olives that are left there for gleaning in olive trees. And all the way from the river Euphrates to the Nile, the river of Egypt, you'll be gathered one by one, O you children of Israel. So no two's going together because they're married, and no kids going with parents if they're stubborn and rebellious. But the ones that are going to be regathered and brought back and planted and be the vine that starts out the millennium to spread fruit all over the earth, they're going to be regathered one by one, O you children of Israel. And it shall come to pass in that day the great trumpet shall be blown. So it shows plainly. You've got the Day of Atonement, the first part of the chapter. You've got the millennium in the middle part. God goes back to talking about Israel's punishment and purging of their sin, and then how he's going to regather them and bring them and plant them, and it's the time of trumpets. There they are, all in one chapter. In that day, the great trumpet. And you know, when you look through the Bible, it's called the last trumpet, it's called the seventh trumpet, it's called the great trumpet, and it's called the trump of God. Four separate descriptions. And there again, that's God's number revealing himself for. You know, the more you look at God's holy days, you ever stop and we read Leviticus 23 and how 12 times in that one chapter he says, these are my feasts, the Eternal's Passover, the Feast of Unleavened Bread, and to the Eternal. And then you notice, you know, if you count up, there are 7 annual Sabbaths in all the feast days. And you know, there are 19 days altogether. Isn't that odd? The Passover is not even a holy day. It was a holy day, but it's not an annual Sabbath. And yet, when you add up the Passover, plus the days of unleavened bread, plus trumpets and atonement and the Feast of Tabernacles, there are 19 days. Isn't that odd? You've got 7 annual Sabbaths, plus 12 that aren't. Altogether, you've got 19 days. Now, there aren't any 19-year time cycles, though. Well, you better look up 19 before you go off on that. Are there 19-year cycles in the heavens? You know, I asked Dr. Ronish down in Big Sandy, who's an astronomist, and I asked him if there was any fact to the rotations of all the heavenly bodies, that they all came together in an exact relationship to one another again every 19 years. And he said, oh, yeah. But you know, if people think they're in the 19-year time cycle, well, they better look a little deeper, you know. They better study a little more. Well, anyway, the last trump, the great trump, the seventh trump, the trump of God, shall be blown, and they shall come who were ready to perish. Now, where were these Israelites purged of their sins? Where were they scattered in all the winds to? All the borders of the earth, where all did they go? Who took them captive? Not the Russians. Not the Japanese, not the Chinese, not the people of India. No, when you get Israel regathered one by one, they were ready to perish in the land of Assyria, in the outcast, in the land of Egypt. And they're going to worship the Eternal in the Holy Mount of Jerusalem. And you know, when you see the term outcasts and dispersed, one talks about Israel and one talks about Judah. And some are going to be taken and scattered by Assyria, and others by Egypt, the Arabs. And you know, it's kind of unique, because in one place where God talks about Egypt, he doesn't call the people Egyptians. He said, the people dwelling in the land of Egypt. And you notice even here he talks about where they're captives. Now, in chapter 28, woe to the crown of pride, to the drunkards of Ephraim, whose glorious beauty is a fading flower, which are on the head of the fat valleys of them that are overcome with wine. So here he's talking about the leadership of the great nation of Israel. Of course, Ephraim was the leader of the 10 nations, without any question. And God talks about the crown of pride. Well, the capital is at Samaria. And the crown of pride, then, would be talking about Samaria. Well, you surely don't think our governmental leaders in Israel drink too much. God talks about the leadership of the 10 tribes and talks about them drinking too much. Cocktails and expense accounts, you know, that are full of what? Eatings and drinkings and partyings. Well, God says the glorious beauty of the 10 tribes of the past is fading away. And you know, all I have to do is go back and look at slides of the old days of the greatness of the nations, and then look at the way they are today. No comparison. You know, when you see the Washington Monument, and you compare it with some of the palaces back in the Middle Ages, no comparison. You know, just a stacked obelisk with a stench in God's nostrils in the first place, that we'd have an obelisk as a national symbol of a national capital. You know, some people say it's like the Vatican over in Rome, that it's just harlotry depicted right there even in the layout of the buildings. Well, God talks about the beauty fading like a fading flower. Behold, the Eternal, the Lord has a mighty and strong one, which has a tempest of hail. Here he's talking again about the beast power that's going to put an end to Israel's pride. The Eternal has a mighty and strong one, the coming beast, which is a tempest of hail and a destroying storm as a flood of mighty waters overflows. Like he says again over in verse 15. When the overflowing scourge passes through like a flooding of waters, shall cast down to the earth with the hand the crown of pride, the drunkards of Ephraim, shall be trodden underfoot, and the glorious beauty that's on the head of the fat valley shall be a fading flower, and as the hasty fruit before the summer. So the first ripe figs are going to be devoured, and the firstlings that are just beginning to produce are all going to be devoured before the summer, which when he that looks upon it sees while it's yet in his hand, he eats it up, just the firstling. In that day shall the Eternal host be for a crown of glory and for a diadem of beauty to the residue of his people. Always talks about a remnant that's left, a residue, a tithe, a gleaning that's going to be left. And then when they're brought back and planted, the Eternal will be a crown of glory, a diadem, for a spirit of judgment to him that sits in judgment. So he'll be our inspiration and we'll be his sons, and he'll be a spirit of judgment to us when we're sitting in judgment. and for strength to them that turn the battle to the gate. So apparently when we're changed to spirit beings at the seventh trumpet, we're going to have a part in helping God intervene and stop the fighting that's going to take place, and even on the end of the millennium. Because he says here, the eternal is going to be for strength to them that turn the battle to the gate, that they also have heard, Judah also, not just the drunkards of Ephraim, but they, Judah, also have heard through wine and through strong drink. And they're out of the way. The priest and the prophet have heard through strong drink. They're swallowed up with wine. They're out of the way through strong drink. They err in vision. They stumble in judgment. In other words, the religious leaders of Judah, instead of being the keepers of the law that God held them accountable for, they ended up being off in judgment. They erred in vision. And they didn't, they're as if they were spiritually drunk. Not that they had to be literally physically. For all tables are full of vomit and filthiness, so there's no place clean. So when you see people like that, the drunkards of Ephraim and the drunkards of Judah, then God says, whom shall he teach knowledge? Seeing that these Ephraimites are all full of pride and drunk, and the people of Judah, instead of being the priest and the prophet, they're all drunk as well spiritually, then whom shall he teach knowledge? And whom shall he make to understand doctrine? Well, the people have to be nourished in the milk of God's word, and then weaned from the milk, and drawn from the breast. They have to have precept on precept, line on line, and here a little and there a little. In other words, God's going to have to supernaturally enlighten them and call them and grant them understanding, because he's described their condition before. Before it's been as with stammering lips and another tongue God has been speaking to them. But all of a sudden, when their eyes are opened and their minds are enlightened, then they're going to understand what God's had to say. To whom he said, this is the rest wherewith you may cause the weary to rest. Teaching the truth, teaching the Sabbath, teaching the holy days. That's rest. Rest from human nature and the world and uncertainty and blindness. That's the rest. You can cause them the weary to rest. This is the refreshing, yet they would not hear. But the word of the eternal was to them precept on precept, precept on precept, line on line, here a little and there a little, that they might go and fall backward and be broken and snared and taken. So even before, unless God enlightened them and unless God was their spirit of judgment in verse 5 and 6, then even precept on precept they didn't understand. They were blinded. Wherefore, hear the word of the eternal, you scornful men that rule this people which is in Jerusalem. Because you said we've made a covenant with death and with hell, are we at agreement? When the overflowing scourge shall pass through, it'll come unto us. We've made lies our refuge. In other words, they trusted in other human governments. They've made covenants, and they'd either die and be buried in the grave and be overflowed with a nation. And instead of trusting God, they trusted in allies. They trusted in human powers. Therefore, thus says the Lord Eternal, verse 16, behold, I lay in Zion for a foundation a stone, a tried stone, a precious cornerstone, a sure foundation. He that believes will not make haste. In other words, anyone that God that believes the Christ and is granted conversion, then they don't make haste. They can be at rest. They have the spirit of judgment. Judgment also I'll lay with the lion, and righteousness to the plummet. The hail shall sweep away the refuge of lies. The water shall overflow the hiding place. So here again, God's removing all the trusting in lies and depending on allies and all that. Your covenant with death shall be disannulled, and your agreement with hell shall not stand. When the overflowing scourge passes through, then you'll be trodden down by it. In other words, you're not going to escape that beast power. You're going to be brought down by it, but you're not going to be wiped out by it. From the time that it goes forth, it'll take you. For morning by morning shall it pass over, by day and by night, and it'll be a vexation only to understand the report. For the bed is shorter than that a man can stretch himself on it, the covering narrower than he can wrap himself in it. So that old Scotch proverb about wishing you a cold night and a short blanket is kind of what Isaiah's saying here. You're going to have a short bed and a small cover and a cold winter. So it's bad news, in other words, until you learn your lesson. For the Eternal shall rise up as in Mount Perazim. He shall be wroth as in the valley of Gibeon, that he may do his work, his strange work, and bring to pass his act, his strange act. Here he's talking about God intervening at Armageddon. His wrath is the seven last plagues, in addition to the first four trumpets. So when the Eternal rises up, the four trumpet plagues start to fall, and then the nations in their battling end up at Armageddon, and then he intervenes and does his work, and brings to pass his act. Now therefore, you be not mockers, lest your bands be made strong. In other words, you better listen to the warning, or God may have to allow it to last longer and be worse. For I've heard from the Lord Eternal of Hosts the consumption, even determined upon the whole earth. So notice, it's not just a matter of little few dozen countries around it, or few countries in the world. This is talking about Armageddon and the consumption, the great tribulation, the threat of the whole earth. Now give you ear and hear my voice, hearken and hear my speech. Does the plowman plow all day to sow? Does he open and break the clods of his ground when he's made plain the face thereof? So notice, God even back then talked about plowing and disking and harrowing to make flat land instead of leaving it just in rows plowed. When he has made plain the face thereof, does he not cast abroad the pitches and scatter the cumin and cast in the principal wheat and the appointed barley and the rye in their place? For his God does instruct him to discretion and does teach him. For the pitches are not threshed with a threshing instrument, neither is the cartwheel turned about upon the cumin, but the pitches are beaten out with a staff and the cumin with a rod. Red corn is bruised because he'll not ever be threshing it, nor break it with the wheel of his cart, nor bruise it with his horses. This also comes forth from the Eternal Host, wonderful in counsel, excellent in working. So before God is going to plant his vine, he's going to have to be sure the soil and the seed and everything is right before he does it. Because a plowman doesn't plow all day. First of all, he's got to open and break the clods, and then he has to make the face flat, and then he has to scatter the seed in its area, and that's what God is going to do after he gets Israel ready to be replanted again. Well, we'll have to pick up with chapter 29, and we almost made it halfway through. We've got a number of chapters that are history, so we'll read through those. Just scanning. We'll pick up the chapter 29 then next week.